south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander...
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
All right, let's hit a few emails. This one comes from Doug. He says, Johnny, I plan on retiring in Guatemala, and I make around $60,000 a year after taxes. Is that enough to live in Guatemala? And that would be just for me. The wife will have about the same amount, too, including her retirement pensions and stuff. He says, it's time to get the frack out of Dodge. That's my plan B. Just a little concerned about what me and the wife make and the cost of living thing. All right, Doug, you're asking if you can live comfortably in Guatemala on $60,000 a year and another $60,000 for your wife. Well, Doug, I don't know. I'd say between you and your wife, you make slightly more than the yearly salary of the president of Guatemala. He makes about $50,000 a year. Of course, he gets all his expenses paid for traveling and all that, so it comes to a lot more. But the actual salary, about $50,000 a year, plus expenses and whatever he can manage to steal. Anyway, Doug, let's see. Is $60,000 enough for a single person to live in Guatemala, or $120,000 for two? Well, first off, you're making more than the president. Of course, you don't have the advantage of the president being able to eat like a pig from the public trough when no one's looking. And of course, I don't think you have multiple million-dollar condos in Cancun and Miami, registered in the wife, kids, and mistress's names. Though, I don't know, maybe you do, Doug. How about it? Let me know. I won't tell. Mum's the word, Doug. Anyway, let me just tell you, Doug, in my case, and I'm a single guy with no kids, I don't have any credit card debt, no house payment, no car payment, and I can easily live like a first-world person for around $1,500 a month. Coincidentally, that'd be your average Social Security check payment, too. And I certainly don't sit at home all the time. And once a week or so, I go to restaurants, I have a glass of wine here and there. But I don't drink hard liquor or beer, and I don't go to the discos and hang out with the guys. Though once in a while, I'll smoke a Cuban or Dominican stogie. So what I'm saying, Doug, is this. Let's say you don't have a car payment. Most gringos and expats don't. They either buy their cars outright or take Ubers and stuff. Let's say you're renting, and the average rent in Guatemala for, let's say, a single person, a single guy, living in a nice neighborhood, maybe $500 a month. We're talking nice, gated, guarded neighborhood, one or two-bedroom place. I'd say if you look around, you can find a real nice one for $500. So, if you live the first world kind of life I do, it would be $1,500 plus $500, that's $2,000 a month. Or about $25,000 a year, right? Now, if you add a wife or significant other, you could probably add $5,000 or $10,000 to that. So, at most, $35,000 a year. That's if you're renting. If you don't have a house payment, apartment rent payment, or car payment. I'd say a couple could easily live for $25,000 or $30,000 a year like a pure first world person. That is, if you don't frequently go to high-end restaurants or drink a lot. So, Doug, in your case, you're saying between the two of you, you and your wife, you make around $120,000 a year. Well, on that kind of dough, you two could easily afford to support a family of, I'd say, 10 kids, as well as two cleaning ladies, a maintenance guy, and a couple of bodyguards. And all of you, except the cleaning lady and the bodyguards, living a first world lifestyle all the way. So, Doug, there you have it. If you're anxious about the cost of living down here, don't fret. Between you and your wife, you make more dough than a congressman, cabinet member, vice president, even the president of Guatemala. However, I wouldn't let on that you make that kind of dough. I wouldn't buy a late model high-end car like an Audi, a Range Rover, or a Mercedes, and skip the bling, even the fake bling. That kind of advice has served me well for the past 25 years. I haven't been robbed in 25 years. Though I've certainly known enough cases where gringos have been robbed, usually because they're wearing gold bling or walking around just staring at that high-end cell phone. Hey, I'm not saying that I couldn't get robbed tomorrow. That can happen anywhere in the world. But hey, just maintain a few simple precautions and the chances you'll be a target will be very, very slim. Speaking of paying rent, did you know, just looking at this article from the States, came out just 2 days ago, the medium average rent in the USA is $2,305. That's for a small two-bedroom place. For a small one-bedroom place in the States, the average is around $1,497. Of course, if you live in a big city or a luxurious part of town like Manhattan or Lakeshore Drive in Chicago, you're going to pay twice or three times that. But remember, the average rent for a one-bedroom in Guatemala City, a decent part of town, is around $500 a month. which works out to about a third of the average rent in the U.S. That should give you a good idea how much you can save by moving down here with your plan B. Of course, if you get away from things and move out in the boonies, there are some nice, out-of-the-way small apartments for $200 and $300 a month. Depends how close you want to get to the local scene, because, you know, the less you pay, the more noisy the neighborhood is. You know, chicken buses rolling by, roosters crowing at 4 in the morning, the junk man, the tortilla and fruit vendors rolling their carts by your front door yelling, aguacates, mangos y limones, aguacates, mangos y limones. So if you can handle that kind of constant noise or block it out. Man, you want to talk about cheap rent? I do know a few gringos and expats who like to be close to the salt of the earth, and they pay $200 a month rent and they're perfectly happy. But most of us, you know, we like to live the first world life. That means a nice neighborhood and or a gated, guarded community. So then you might ask, what can you get in Guatemala or Salvador, Nicaragua, Panama, Mexico, anywhere in Central or South America for $1,500 a month? That'd be the average price in the States right now for a one-bedroom apartment. Well, down here, that'll get you something extremely nice, upper middle class. Something you'd pay at least $3,000 or $4,000 a month for up in the States. Down here, for $1,500 a month, for one thing, you'd be in a great neighborhood. It'd be a big, well-appointed house, big garden, or a 3 or 4 bedroom apartment with all the fixings. Now, of course, if you come down to, let's say, Guatemala City or Antigua Guatemala, Panama City, Roatan, Honduras, you don't know anyone, you don't know your way around, you haven't got a network, you don't know a soul, you don't speak Spanish, and you're looking for a place to rent, guess what you're going to do? You're most likely going to go on the internet and look for rentals with rental companies that advertise in English, like Century 21 and Remax. Yep, they're down here too. And now you're talking about gringo prices, which are still much cheaper than prices up in the States. But, for example, an apartment that a local might be able to get for $500 a month, if you go through Century 21, Remax, or any of the English-speaking rental agencies, you'll likely be quoted $700, $800, or $900 a month for the very same property. But you knew that already, right? That's why it's always in your advantage to have a Latino, a local, do your apartment scouting and negotiating for you. In fact, you should set it up so that a local Latino or Latina looks at the apartment first before you even see it. That way the owner or the landlord doesn't get a preconceived notion that there's a gringo to be gouged. By the way, that's what my seminar logistics lady, Rita, does for newbie gringos and expats all the time. Newbies and wannabes do a phone consult with her first. They talk about their wants and needs regarding apartments, neighborhoods, and their budget. Hire her for a few days to scout out apartments, and when they actually physically come down, Rita's got a nice apartment hunting itinerary all set up. But if you've been listening to the show for a while, you knew that already, right? By the way, if you don't have a plan B in Latin America and plan on retiring up in the States, and all you've got is Social Security, that's all you're banking on, you've got no other pension. Mark my words, here's what you got to look forward to. If you're renting, you might as well just turn over your Social Security check to your landlord every month. Apply for food stamps and hope that Medicaid will pay for all the medicines you'll be on, you know, 5 at 50 and all that. That's basically the retirement plan for millions who are counting just on Social Security. Though it could be worse. You could own your home, which normally would be a very good thing. Except for the fact that the average American homeowner pays $2,500 a month on average for property taxes each year. Of course, that depends a lot on what state you live in. For example, Alabama has the lowest median property tax of around $600 a year. And New Jersey, the highest. The average person in New Jersey who owns a house pays $8,300 a year. And that would eat up about half of the average year's Social Security payment, which is around $16,000 a year. Worse yet, if you own a house, you know the maintenance costs never end. There's electrical, plumbing, roofing repairs. There'll be appliances to fix and replace. There'll be AC and central heating problems. The older the house, the more things deteriorate, too. And most people who retire and own their own house bought it new, but it's 30, 40, or even 50 years old now. Man, that'd be reason 5,446 through 87, why it's time to get the hell out of Dodge. Bottom line, all the evidence indicates the only way to live a proper first world life if you're only depending on Social Security for your retirement in ripe old age is to get the hell out of Dodge, have a plan B in a third world country, preferably in Latin America. Why? Because it's a proven pathway to the good life. The fact is, there are tens of thousands of Americans, Canadians, and Europeans living in Latin America who are living such a good life they'll never consider going back to their country of origin. Though many of them might get homesick at first, after a while, they don't even want to go back to visit. Why do you think that is? Well, I think you know. By the way, my mother, who has her own house, she lives in the northern burbs of Chicago. It's only one of those little tract houses, 1,200 square feet. Nothing special, but to her, lots of memories and home sweet home. My parents bought the place new in 1960 for around 18 grand. The yearly property tax is now around 4 grand. She's on a budget plan. She pays 300 and something bucks a month to the state for property taxes, which still, when you bring it up, bugs the hell out of her because she said her house payment on the original mortgage was about half that, about 180 bucks a month. It's a terrible shame, even a disgrace. What the U.S. government has done to the economy and to the little guy makes you want to cry, doesn't it? Well, instead of crying, I got a better idea. Get the hell out of Dodge. You can do that, you know, and that's what this show is all about. Or you can just sit there and whine and keep taking it up the trasero, year after year, losing more of your freedoms and liberties all the time. Or do the smart thing. Vote with your feet. All right, moving on. Let's take another email now. This is from Eric. He says, Johnny, does El Salvador have an altiplano region like Guatemala has? Well, Eric, good question. Here's the story. You know, Guatemala is the biggest country in Central America. And that altiplano region we talk about all the time, that's got that perfect spring weather all year round. It runs pretty much from where Guatemala starts, right where the Mexican border is, all the way through the country. If you're driving on the Pan-American Highway, you're almost always in the altiplano when you're taking that route through Guatemala. However, not all of Guatemala is in the altiplano. Just a long, wide strip through the center of the country. Which is why you could be living in the altiplano and an hour or so later be right at the beach where it's blistering hot. Now, as you're heading south through Guatemala on the Pan-American Highway, there'll come a point about 2 hours out of Guatemala City driving south where you'll hit the border with El Salvador. At that point, once you cross the border into El Salvador, there's about a 50-mile stretch into El Salvador that's considered altiplano. That's a coffee-growing region of El Salvador, also known as La Ruta del Flores, the flower route. What do you think they call it that for? There are flowers blooming everywhere. Now, that route is mostly in the boonies. And once you cross the border, if you head towards a town called Sansonate, you're out of the altiplano now. It's about 700 feet above sea level, heading towards the Pacific Ocean. It's one of the bigger towns, which is very small by El Salvador standards, only 70,000 people. Now, if you head on one of the roads that goes southeast to a town called Santa Ana, a small to medium-sized city of around 300,000 people, you're still in the altiplano. Now, Santa Ana, it's about 3,000 feet above sea level. And remember, for every 1,000 feet above sea level, the ambient temperature drops about 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit. So, in Santa Ana, you're about 10 degrees cooler all the time than it is on the coast. Now, as for me, 3,000 feet above sea level is just scraping the bottom of the altiplano. The altiplano I'm used to living in is about 5,000 feet above sea level, or 15 degrees cooler than the temperature at the coast. So, if during the day the temperature is 88 at the coast, it's about 73 Fahrenheit at 5,000 feet. Practically the perfect temperature. Not too cold to shiver, not too hot to sweat. So once again, if you're traveling on the Pan-American Highway south from Guatemala into El Salvador, you're going to be in the altiplano or skirting the bottom reaches of it for the next 50 miles. Unfortunately for us, though, almost all of the altiplano in El Salvador is out in the boonies. So apart from Santa Ana, a town of 300,000, you're not really too close to the activities or availability of things in the big city. To me, the only city in El Salvador that's got everything you need, I mean for a person like me, a gringo who's used to living in a big city like Chicago, is San Salvador, the capital. It's got over 2 million people, so they've got everything. But it doesn't quite qualify as being in the altiplano. It's only 2,000 feet above sea level. That means it's about 7 degrees cooler than being at the coast. Not much, but you do get some relief. So in other words, if you want to homestead, have a finca, a nice big farm, coffee, or whatever, and still be in the altiplano, I'd say that 50-mile stretch coming in from Guatemala, the Ruta del Flores, is the perfect place to do that. Except you're going to be kind of isolated. Though I know some gringos and expats who do live there and they love it. Not my style, though. A little too isolated for me. Personally, I need to be within a half hour or so of having the conveniences of a big city. I like to have access to things like Walmart, Costco, a couple of big shopping centers, and a Miami mailbox courier connection where I could get my stuff from Amazon, eBay and other online stores. Sure, I could do without that stuff, and I did go without for at least 20 years when that stuff just didn't exist. But for all the reasons, political and otherwise, you could hate big monoliths like Amazon, Walmart, and Costco. Nevertheless, like those damn cell phones, you do get used to those conveniences. So, until further notice, I prefer to have access to them. I keep thinking, if I protest and boycott them, it won't do a thing to them, but would cause me a little bit of a hardship. If you protest individually, it's like a drop in the ocean. However, when it comes to Google, Facebook, Twaddle, Instacrap, and the rest of anti-social media, those companies never did provide a useful commodity or service to me, unlike Amazon or Costco. So it's easy to not engage with them at all. I'm sure a lot of you feel the same way. So, like any good hypocrite, I begrudgingly use places like Amazon, Walmart, and Costco. How about you? Do you use Amazon in those big box stores, yet despise anti-social media so much that you've shit-canned them? Are you a lot like me? I wonder. All right, another short and sweet email from Scott this time. He says, Johnny, what's that email service you were recommending on your podcast? The one that lets you have a bunch of different email addressed aliases. Thanks in advance, Johnny. Signed, Scott. All right, Scott, it's startmail.com. Now, the same company has startpage.com, which is an anonymous web search engine like the Brave browser. I use that too in conjunction with startmail.com. Startmail.com costs about, I'm thinking, $60 a year. The beauty of it is it lets you make any number of email aliases on the fly. For example, just a few days ago, I was looking at a detailed city map of Sao Paulo, Argentina, but I couldn't get down to the actual street level. Well, it said, yeah, we'll give you a map of the absolute street level. Just give us your email. We'll send you a link right there. You click on it and you'll get a download. Well, you know, when you do that, they're going to sell your email to a ton of people. You're going to get all kinds of spam and junk forever. All a bunch of time-wasting junk that fills up your email box. So then at that very instant, I minimize that window, open my StartMail account, click on aliases. You've got two options to choose from. Option one is custom aliases. Those are aliases you want to keep for a long, long time, or maybe just for a month or a week or a year or forever. For example, if you subscribe to any service like Spotify or the Daily Wire, and you don't want to receive junk mail from them, but you need to have an email address to sign up and initialize the account. By the way, to make it less confusing when you make a lot of custom email accounts, trying to sort them out and stuff, when you create one, you put a reference word in there so you'll remember. Like, I put the word Spotify into that email address that I created, so that any email that comes into that email account I know came from Spotify, and if they sold it to anyone, I know they did that too. And any email you get from them will go there, and any junk mail you get because they sold your email address will go there too. As for me, over the years, I've accumulated maybe 10 custom aliases. You can turn them on and off at will, too. Delete them or keep them as well. For example, when my brother was using Latin Cupid to try to hook up with ladies, I told him to subscribe to StartMail so he could create an alias email address with the word Cupid in it. Because, you know, once he signed up for that service and gave his email, you know they're going to sell it all over the place. He's going to get all kinds of junk mail. He wanted them all to land in that particular email box. He also knew it would probably get out of control because those ladies, the ones that are trying to rip you off or gouge you, will be passing his email around too to all their friends who are ripoff artists. And man, did that email box fill up with junk. And eventually, when he found the girl of his dreams, or the girl he thought was the girl of his dreams, he created a new custom alias email just for her so they could correspond, and he deleted the other custom alias that had the word Cupid in it. So anyone sending an email there would get a message saying it was undeliverable. However, in the future, let's say his present girlfriend didn't work out and he wanted to get back on a Cupid site, he could just reactivate it with a click, and now he could get back into the futile and frustrating business of finding a mate online. So that's option one. You heard me say there's two options. The other one is to create a burner alias. Again, a burner alias is a temporary email address that you can use so you don't have to give out your main address to sketchy sites or online services you're not committed to. Burner addresses are generated with a simple click and automatically disappear after 1 hour, so you never have to worry about receiving spam at that site again. You use a burner alias when you need an email address to download a white paper, unlock a coupon code, sign up for an online service, but don't want to share your email address with the site. And you know, lots of times when you're trying to download something, they'll make you put in an email address, and you'll have to verify when they send you an email and click a link. Those burner aliases are great for that, because they only last 1 hour. And when you sign up to get a download, you just go to your Start Mail account. You'll get the email from who's ever downloading whatever to you. You open that email, click the link, you get the download, and within the hour, that address is gone forever. Maybe I should explain just a little more how this works. Let's say you go to Start Mail, pay the $60, and select your main email address. Let's say it's ihateeffinwokesters@startmail.com. Well, that's how you get into your account, with a password, of course, that you select. And once you're in there, you go to aliases and create those aliases, whether it's a burner alias or a custom alias. And of course, you can only find out if you're getting emails by going into your main Start Mail address, which is ihateeffinwokesters@startmail.com. The other alias email accounts you created will be nested within the main account. So when you click on your inbox, that's where all the emails sent to you will come in, including emails sent to your alias email accounts. So then how do you know which emails are coming into your alias accounts? Well, when you click on an email, it says so right in the header. Clear as mud, huh? Man, I tell you, I just love this service. I'm addicted to it. I can't tell you how many dozens, probably hundreds or thousands of junk mail pieces and spam I've averted by using this service. Now, I know a lot of you guys and gals like to use Proton Mail. It's a great service, too. I have it myself. I bought it for their VPN. I rarely use the email part, though. By the way, I think that's around $60 a year, too. So then what's the difference between Proton Mail and Start Mail? Well, guess what? Proton Mail has aliases, too. Problem is, it's only got one alias. You have your regular account in whatever name you chose at protonmail.com. Plus, they let you select an alias, and you pick that, whatever it is, at protonmail.com. But I found out a long time ago, years ago, one alias is not enough. Like I said, I've got at least 10 custom aliases going right now on my Start Mail account. For example, you could use one specifically if you've got an Amazon account. You put the word Amazon into it, so you know every email coming through there is coming through the Amazon service, or maybe they sold that email to someone and now you're getting spammed. Well, then you could just delete that one and get another. Let's say you buy online from eBay. You can create a custom alias email for them, too. Now, as for me, recently I got a Carfax report. It cost $49. And I just know if I gave them an email address, they're going to sell it to people, and I'm going to get all kinds of car-related things coming at me. Car spam. Well, I created a custom alias with the word Carfax in it. And we'll see how much spam I get there. And believe me, if I get any at all, I'm just going to delete that account because I already got my Carfax report for the car in question I was checking out. But I could not have accomplished that without giving them an email so they could send me the report. You get it? Which reminds me, if you're checking out cars down here, used cars, it's a really good idea. If you're interested in one that's coming from the States, I highly recommend before you buy it, get a Carfax report. By the way, you could easily tell it was shipped in from the States because the odometer will be in miles instead of kilometers. However, if the odometer is in kilometers, it's a car that was sold new at a dealership in Latin America, and it won't be registered with Carfax. Carfax is only for cars that originated up in the U.S., but there are tons of cars that originated up in the U.S. and got shipped down. So let's say you're on Encuentros 24, that's the Latin American Craigslist for Guatemala. You're checking out vehicles and you find a beautiful Honda CR-V, let's say 2021. Looks great in the photos, has really low mileage, let's say 8 or 9,000 miles. You're thinking, wow, this thing's still a baby, not even broken in yet. Well, my suggestion is you jot down the serial number, the VIN number, V-I-N. It's on the dashboard. And when you go back home, get on your computer, go to Carfax.com, spend the $49 and have them run a report on it. That way you'll find out its service record, if it's ever been totaled, if it's been in for a big or minor repair. And you'll probably even see the last time it got an oil change. You'll be able to know if they've rolled back the mileage on it or not, because you know, it's a big thing these days. As much as you want to believe that low mileage you're seeing on the odometer is real, and as much as you want to believe in this day and age that stuff being digital is tamper-proof, well, you're wrong. Well, a Carfax report will show you the history of that car, warts and all. I mean, look, let's say you're going to spend 10, 15, even 20 grand on a used car. What's $49? Wouldn't you want to know if that thing was salvaged from a flood? You know, there's been lots of floods up in the States lately. Wouldn't you like to know if it had big repairs done or was totaled? Wouldn't you like to know if they rolled back the odometer 30 or 40,000 miles? In fact, if you go to the Carfax.com site itself, it says, our research indicates that more than 2 million vehicles on the road in the U.S. have rolled back odometers, a 7% increase from the previous year. They even list the 10 states nationwide with the most vehicles with rolled back odometers. And according to their data, it says consumers lose an average of $4,000 in value from unknowingly buying a car with a rolled back odometer. And then there's the fact that a car with a lot more miles on it than you think it has will be needing maintenance all that much sooner because parts are wearing down faster than the rolled back or faked mileage will have you believe. It goes on to say even a small adjustment of a few thousand miles in reverse will affect the car value. However, most odometer tampering incidents involve tens of thousands of miles. That means, for example, a seven-year-old car showing 40,000 miles on the odometer probably actually had 90,000 miles or more if it was rolled back. What's the point of going through all that trouble to roll back the mileage only a few thousand miles? Why not make it seem like a seven-year-old car was only driven to church on Sundays by a little old lady? After all, a seven-year-old car showing only 40,000 miles on the odometer should technically read 70,000 to 90,000 miles if it had just the average amount of miles racked up, about 12,000 to 15,000 miles a year in the U.S. The other thing is that a car with extra low mileage almost always has a full Carfax report. Low mileage cars are generally very well taken care of. The conscientious owner takes it back to the dealer for all the recommended maintenance checks. Those maintenance checks and intervals get recorded to make sure the factory warranties are valid. As a result, dealer maintenance records are registered online and end up in Carfax reports. So then what happens if you're in Latin America and you buy a nice used car? You take it back for maintenance and your mechanic says, hey, this car doesn't have 40,000 miles on it. It's got a lot more because he sees under the hood the telltale signs of a car that's got a lot more wear and tear. A good mechanic can spot those things. Well, suppose then you get kind of upset about it and you run a Carfax report after the fact and you see the miles have been rolled back. What can you do? Well, in the States, you can sue and win. But down here in Latin America, you're just shit out of luck. Oh, well. Rule number one in Latin America when it comes to purchasing anything at all? Buyer beware. I've said that before. After you've been gouged a few times, you'll know what I mean. It happens to all of us. But we learn, though some of us a lot slower than others. By the way, full disclosure here. You wonder why I know so much about this subject? I was scammed in that exact same way some 15 or 20 years ago. A long time ago. But even so, when I think about it, doesn't hurt any less. My only consolation is that back then, there was no Carfax to check out.
You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, we can schedule a one-on-one phone or Skype consult. Just send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to get on the waiting list for my next week-long Expat Insider Seminar in Central America, where you're guaranteed to get a 2 to 5 year head start on your Plan B, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos.